All right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for tonight's Cattle Industry Update with Oklahoma Farm Bureau. We're going to get going with tonight's program. I'm Dustin Milkey. I'm Vice President of Communications and Public Relations for Oklahoma Farm Bureau. Tonight's format is that we're going to start with some comments here in a moment from Oklahoma Farm Bureau President Rod Mozell. Then after that, we will hand it to our panelists to make some opening statements. Tonight, we're lucky enough to have Dr. Darrell Peel with Oklahoma State University, Scott Bennett with American Farm Bureau, and Michael Nephew with American Farm Bureau. They will give some opening statements to get their thoughts on the current state of the cattle industry. And then after that, we'll go into a question and answer session. We'll get some closing statements from each of our panelists, and then we will wrap up for the evening. So to get started, we're going to start off with some comments from Oklahoma Farm Bureau by Oklahoma Farm Bureau President Rod Mozell. Rod.
Good evening. We're so excited to have you all join us this evening and excited about the wonderful response from those of you that indicated ahead of time you were going to join us. And I suspect there's some extra folks that are just joining us live. Oklahoma Farm Bureau is trying to get more engaged in using this technology to help communicate with our members and the ag community as we're dealing with just really unusual circumstances following the COVID-19. We've done a couple of webinars in the last 2 weeks on the Paycheck Protection Act since Farm Bureau played a key role along with Congressman Lucas and Senator Lankford in getting the farm and rural community included in that Paycheck Protection Act. And so if you aren't familiar with that and haven't applied yet, we hope you'll check out recordings of those videos, which are out on our webpage for Oklahoma Farm Bureau. We also plan to do some more of these over the next couple weeks as it becomes clear what Secretary Perdue is going to do with the $9.5 billion that Congress allotted to him to help deal with hotspots or special needs within the agricultural community, and the $14 billion that was allocated for CCC programming. So as soon as we kind of know what's going on in those, we plan to hold additional webinars with experts to help bring that information to you as we work together to try to figure out how to keep Oklahoma agriculture strong and vital and to keep all the operations that we've got now growing. We appreciate your being Farm Bureau members. Hope you'll encourage your friends and neighbors to be Farm Bureau members, whether they buy our insurance or not. We're trying hard to stand up for agriculture. We encourage you to be a member of your commodity group from whatever industry you are, but also to be a member of Oklahoma Farm Bureau, which represents the full spectrum of agriculture, which is so important with the issues that we're dealing with now, as we've seen these complete disruptions of many of our agricultural markets. I want to take a special moment to say how excited we are to have Dr. Darrell Peel from OSU participating. And he's just spent a big part of the last couple of weeks working on a special task force with the National Cattlemen and actually headed that task force with a number of other bright minds around the country to try to think about how the secretary and others could use the funds that are out there to help support the cattle industry and to deal with these disruptions. And so it's a real excitement after he just pulled an all-nighter last night to have him here with us this evening. And then in my service on the American Farm Bureau Board, I've had the chance to get to know Scott and Michael over this last year or better, and very impressed with the talent of both these folks. And so we're so excited that Scott and Michael are able to join us on the panel tonight. And so I know you're all here to hear about all these changes that have been going on in the cattle market. Beef is by far our most important agricultural commodity in our state. It's the highest value commodity. And even an old greenhouse boy like me can recognize how important cattle are and beef are. And so it's very important to our state and to our country to protect the beef industry and the cattle industry. And so that's why we're bringing you this programming tonight. We'll look forward to your comments afterwards and hope that you'll find it helpful. Please, if you have questions during the deal, feel free to text them to Steve or Thad or I, and we'll keep passing them around and so that Dustin can be asking them as he works with our panel. But thanks especially to all of you for joining us and to the great panel. And now let's learn some more about the beef market.
Thank you, Rod. And next, we're going to hear from each of our panelists as they give us a quick opening statement and their thoughts and comments on the current state of the cattle industry. First, we will hear from Dr. Daryl Peel. And Dr. Daryl Peel is the Charles Breedlove Professor of Agribusiness in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Oklahoma State University, focusing on livestock market outlook and marketing risk management education for livestock producers. He has served as the Extension Livestock Marketing Specialist since he came to Oklahoma State University in 1989. Peel has his BS and MS degrees from Montana State University and a PhD from the University of Illinois. So, Dr. Peel?
Very good. Thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you tonight, and thanks to all of you that are joining us this evening. It's a completely unprecedented time that we find ourselves in the country, indeed in the whole world, with impacts across the board in every sector of our economy, and certainly agriculture is included in that, and the beef markets. And so we've just seen absolutely unprecedented challenges and volatility in these markets that runs the gamut from the consumer side and the impacts we've seen over the last month with our two main food marketing channels in this country, one being food service that really goes to the restaurants and institutions, schools and the like, and the other is our retail grocery side. And by effectively closing one down, or very nearly closing one of those down, the food service side, and we put tremendous burden and expectations on the grocery side. And that has created enormous logistical and bottleneck issues at a time when we have plenty of food, and beef certainly is part of that. We've seen shortages in the grocery store simply because of those logistical challenges. We're beginning to work through some of those, but they're still there because there is that enormous challenge as long as the food service side remains closed. More recently, in the last few days, of course, the next iteration of these issues takes fold in terms of the direct risk to our ability to continue processing livestock in this country, to processing cattle in the packing plants, as the COVID-19 is affecting the labor force in many of these institutions. And so right now, we've got a tremendous amount of uncertainty. We do have some facilities that are either closed down for some period of time or working at restricted levels of production. And there is a continuing threat, and probably will be for some weeks now, of multiple plants being offline and potentially disruptions in the flow of products, which could continue to cause those kinds of supply issues all the way to the consumer level. We just don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty at this point in time. Obviously, livestock markets have been tremendously infected, really going back to early February, late January, when the news coming out of China was, and the impacts were actually being felt there initially in terms of disruptions in international trade. And then, of course, more recently, it's gotten much more severe here in the U.S., in terms of, you know, on the one hand, we've had spikes in box beef prices because of trying to work through these logistical bottlenecks. At the same time, of course, the uncertainty, the risks, the reality really that we are in a recession in the U.S. and we don't know what that means going forward here for a while, means that we've had some real pressures on our cattle markets. And now complicated by potential questions about our ability to even process these cattle in a timely fashion. So lots of issues. I'm looking forward to your questions and the chance to visit with you a little bit more.
Thank you, Dr. Peel. Next up on our panel, we have Scott Bennett. Scott serves as the American Farm Bureau Federation's Director of Congressional Relations. His issues portfolio is comprised of livestock and related issues, including GPSA, cell-based proteins, gene editing, and mandatory price reporting. Bennett also manages AFBF's efforts on hemp, child nutrition and dietary guidelines, and agricultural research. Bennett has been with the American Farm Bureau Federation since October of 2018. His prior experience includes serving as legislative director for former House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte, where he guided the chairman through policy discussions as a conferee for the 2018 Farm Bill. So, Scott?
Thank you very much, Dustin, and I appreciate the opportunity from Oklahoma Farm Bureau to participate this evening. I'd just like to give a lay of the land from a political standpoint as to the response the government has taken in lieu of this pandemic that we find ourselves in. As many people know, the CARES Act is the $2.2 trillion package for recovery to the United States. It is known as phase three. What many people may not be extremely aware of is that we've actually had two prior bills to this one that are circumstantial and address the COVID-19 pandemic that we find ourselves in. This third phase, the CARES Act, it provides $14 billion to replenish the Commodity Credit Corporation at USDA, which many people may be familiar with as the $30 billion treasure chest at USDA that has historically provided the market facilitation payment program last year from the China and U.S. trade disruption. In addition to the $14 billion CCC replenishment, there's been $9.5 billion allotted to USDA for COVID-19 aid. And earmarked in that $9.5 billion is that for specialty crops and livestock. And I think it's important for people to understand that not just specialty crops and livestock have access to that $9.5 billion. When we look at that $2.2 trillion CARES Act package, that $24-ish billion is what USDA has to work with. So I think the $1 million question that people in the cattle business are asking themselves is, how much of that will they get and when will they be paid? And my answer to that is it's a work in progress. At American Farm Bureau and Oklahoma Farm Bureau have been working closely with USDA. We have constant communication with the folks in that agency, and they understand the precedent that this money has and the potential benefit that it could have to our producers. We have advocated that this money is needed and it is urgent. It is needed sooner rather than later. That being said, American Farm Bureau encourages USDA to construct a program, especially that to cattle producers, that's equitable to all sectors of the industry. You have folks in the cow-calf industry, which I am a student of. I was born and raised on a cow-calf operation in Southside, Virginia. My entire family makes a living in the cattle business, so this hits very close to home for me. As well as the backgrounder, the stocker, the feeder, we are encouraging USDA to use monies that would be deemed for livestock aid to be distributed in an equitable manner, that it would be beneficial to the cow-calf producer. I think those that have a lot of cattle, that feed a lot of cattle or background a lot of cattle, they typically have a risk management protocol in place, but the smaller cow-calf producer may not have a risk management protocol in place, and rightfully so. And so when those folks go to sell their cattle and they realize that it is at a significant discount due to the circumstances our economy finds herself in, we feel that USDA needs to reflect their aid to those producers in an equitable manner. Kind of moving along, and I think another significant aspect of this is the packing capacity in the United States and how that's been affected over the past few weeks and how it will continue to likely decline. American Farm Bureau remains in constant communications with the packing industry. We understand the circumstances that they are in. You see line workers on the plants not showing up for work. The packing capacity's been declining, and in some cases, packing plants have shut down. We urge the packing industry to do whatever they can to keep their line workers safe, but also keep these plants open. That's a part of the supply chain that is imperative for our producer community. And in order for the throughput of our industry to remain efficient, it's important that these packing plants stay open. So we remain in constant communication with the packing industry to articulate that viewpoint. And we know there is some heartache in the country about the packer margin. But at the same time, we know that they play an integral role in the supply chain and that it's important that they stay open. Another thing I'd like to mention is that, you know, we see these packing plants shut down. It's important to know, and as a Farm Bureau member and folk and an organization that not only has to answer to our producer members, but you know, answer questions to the consumer side of things, it's important to understand that these plants shutting down, it is not due to a food safety risk. Let's use the soldered in Pennsylvania JBS plant, for example. That plant has been shut down and will reopen here at the end of the week, I believe. The reason for that plant shutting down is the management team, the supervisors and the plant managers, they came down with this virus, and due to that, they had to shut the plant down. These plants are designed to be disinfected. Every single day between shifts, they are disinfected for Listeria, E. coli, Salmonella. That same protocol without change kills the COVID-19 virus as well. These plants are safe. Consumers' food is safe. It is the sake of the worker. It is the fact that the workers are coming down with this virus and inhibiting the ability for that plant to remain open. And that is the reason for many of these plants shutting down. Switching gears again, I'd just like to bring folks up to speed of some actions that have been taken on Capitol Hill in the last few weeks on this. Colin Peterson, the House Agriculture Committee chairman, penned a letter to the Department of Justice and CFTC last week asking for further investigation into the cattle markets. We've seen an extremely volatile cattle market, as we have the general stock market. That letter had landed on the desk of Attorney General Barr and CFTC Chairman Talbert. We encourage that at American Farm Bureau. We had a conversation, and I will let Michael Nephew, who will present after me, elaborate on this a little bit more. But we had a conversation with CFTC Talbert. He is fully aware of the concerns of Farm Bureau members that this cattle market raises. In addition to that, as we look at the implementation of this CARES Act and the $24 billion that USDA has discretion to spend to make producers right, there was a congressional letter sent to the secretary on behalf of the general livestock industry, that being cattle, pork, and poultry, just addressing the situation that we find ourselves in, how unique it is, and the fact that it's imperative that USDA work in a manner that is swift, but also fully incorporates all of the proteins. When we take the slice of the pie that the cattle industry will get, American Farm Bureau is beating the drum on a daily basis that not only do larger producers get their share of this aid, but that the smaller cow-calf producers get that aid. So with that, Dustin, I really appreciate the opportunity to join you this evening. I look forward to the questions, and I encourage folks to eat beef. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. We appreciate having you. Our next guest panelist is Michael Nephew. Michael Nephew serves as an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation. His issue portfolio consists of livestock and dairy markets, farm bill and federal crop insurance, renewable fuels, and hemp issues. Nephew joined AFBF as an economist in May of 2018. He comes to AFBF from Informa Economics Agribusiness Group, where he was an analyst charged with conducting policy and economic research. His prior experience also includes placements with the Agriculture Department's Foreign Agricultural Service and the House Agriculture Committee. Nephew earned a bachelor's degree in agribusiness and economics and a master's degree in agricultural economics, both from Texas A&M University. So, Michael, if you would like to make your opening comments.
Sure, and thank you very much for having me on. Really, I think I would like to expand a little bit on some of what Scott mentioned in terms of AFBF's efforts, and then talk a little bit about some of what Dr. Peel had already mentioned, with the large caveat being that I 100% defer to Dr. Peel on many of these issues. He absolutely is an expert in this, and has he's just an absolute wealth of knowledge on this. So one thing just to hammer home is that, you know, we've heard you. Not just Oklahoma producers and Oklahoma Farm Bureau, you got a great group of folks there, but producers all across the country, anybody involved in livestock production has made a lot of these concerns known to us. And like Scott mentioned, we're running with it and we are moving forward at the national level. So he had talked a little bit about the calls we've had with, say, CFTC. I can say there's a great group of folks over there who are really trying to understand the issue, and they're really taking this seriously and looking at it in a very serious manner. We had a call with, as Scott mentioned, Chairman Taubert, between American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall and a few of staff on the call as well. And again, just a fantastic group of folks over there who really understand this issue. And then in addition to that, President Duvall also had a call with the CME. Again, the purpose of these calls is to relay your concerns, the producer level, the grassroots member concerns, to these regulators and to these market administrators, basically, and trying to make sure they understand some of the concerns and the heartburn that you're really feeling out there in cattle country. We're working, Scott mentioned several groups that we're working with, the Packers, we're working with USDA. We're also working with Livestock Marketing Association. When talking about it, yes, we absolutely need the packer as a way to transform that cow into meat for the consumer to eat. But cow-calf producers also need auction markets. They need a means and ability to sell their cattle. And that is an issue that LMA is working on hard. There's been really low volume at a lot of auctions out there. These auctions are trying to figure out the best way to adapt to the social distancing policy and able to still efficiently, as best they can, move cattle through the system. We talked a little bit about packing plants closing down. To date, unless there's been a news release in the last 30 minutes that I missed, we're sitting about 7 to 8% of pork and beef processing capacity, and like both of them are being down toward due to plant closures. Now that's specifically plant closures, public information where we know that, you know, the Soderton plant is down, the Sioux Falls plant just went down over the weekend. We know general idea of what their processing capacity is. That's a huge challenge. In addition to that, and what's incredibly concerning to me, is beyond absolute plant closures, what we're seeing in terms of reduced line speeds. This is harder to quantify. We don't fully know what the reduction in processing capacity is due to that. We've seen a drop in slaughter. That data comes out daily and weekly from USDA. But that's something where I think it has the potential to have a much broader magnified impact on the industry is exactly once we figure out how bad that is. Some of it is due to what Scott was mentioning, struggling with labor shortages. Workers are scared to show up to work. They don't want to get sick. Some of them have kids at home. They can't really there's no daycares, they're not going to school. It's a lot to juggle for a lot of folks out there, and we understand worker healthcare safety is incredibly important. And it's just, in addition to that, these plants are having to adopt social distancing policies to the best of their ability. This is traditionally a type of work that we keep using the phrase elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder as they're processing. That doesn't really lend itself to a 6-foot distance between folks. So that's one where just the act of spacing them out as best they can is really helping to contribute to that reduction in line speeds. Touching on a few of the things Dr. Peel had said, a lot of folks look at that initial cutout spike and don't really try to think about like why that actually happened. Since then, it's come crashing down, not all the way, but pretty significantly. But that initial spike was not driven by your middle meats. It was really driven by value in the end meats, your chuck and round. Those primals, they skyrocketed. And part of that is those are utilized a little bit more heavily at the retail level. They are also more often going to be used in something like ground beef, whereas the most expensive cut, you think about the tenderloin, its value initially had been cratering because that relies very heavily on food service. Now, beef in general is more exposed to the food service industry and restaurant industry than some of the other proteins. So that's going to be a real challenge moving forward for beef when we think about what's the next step. It's going to take a while for consumers to get back out to restaurants, even when all the quarantines and shelter-in-place orders are lifted. Just because the government says you can do it doesn't mean people are going to start doing it immediately. I think that's going to be a real challenge moving forward is how we have the system set up and how much it relies on that food service sector, because Americans before COVID-19 had been spending the majority of their food dollars away from the home. And now you can't just flip a switch, snap your fingers and shift all of that product that was moving through the system into food service, and then just shift it over to retail immediately. It doesn't quite work like that. There are product specifications. There are different regulations about what's required to be labeled on the product. It's different for a consumer expecting an 8-ounce bags of shredded cheese versus a 10-pound bag that the mom and pop pizza shops are buying. There's a lot of those issues to work through that it's a big challenge for the system, but ag and the food system is adapting pretty quickly and doing a pretty good job of dealing with this unprecedented time. One last thing that I'd really like to touch on is, it was mentioned by Dr. Peel, is the potential recessionary fears, pressures that we're going to feel maybe towards the point where we start coming out of this. Animal proteins can struggle in a recession, beef in particular. Now, I use the term, it's technically, economically a luxury product. I personally view it as a necessity. But, you know, when consumers are going to the retail, to the grocery store, and they have less dollars in their pocket because the wages are cut or they're out of a job, beef is more expensive. It's a fantastic product. It's better than some of those other animal proteins, and so it costs more. The consumer is going to have trouble spending that money on beef whenever they can make that dollar stretch further by purchasing maybe chicken thighs as opposed to some of your steaks that we really look forward to eating at the end of the day. So I think with that, I'll pass it back. I think I've used up a good amount of my introduction time, but looking forward to the questions. Thank you very much for having me, and you got a great group of folks down there at Oklahoma Farm Bureau.
Thank you, Michael. We appreciate your comments. The next thing that we will do is move into the question and answer session with our panelists. And I know there's been a lot of questions submitted, and we're looking forward to diving a little bit deeper into some of these issues that we're seeing. So really to skip, I guess, right direct into the heart of many of the questions that we received, Dr. Peel, we'll pose this to you to start with. What is the source of the disparity that our ag producers are seeing as they look at prices of local cash cattle, futures markets, box beef pricing, and even what we've seen consumers pay in the grocery stores the last few weeks?
You know, these markets are remarkably complex, and I think that's part of what we're seeing here. If you think about retail beef prices, wholesale beef prices, fed cattle prices, feeder cattle prices, all the way down to calf prices, those markets are all connected over time. But obviously, those were very different flows of products at any one point in time. they're not connected by a rigid bar or a chain. They're connected by more of a bungee cord, and so they will move together over time. But one of the things that a shock like we've been in the last month really illustrates is that in the immediate term, a week, 2 weeks, so on, markets like the boxed beef market are really scrambling to find product. Grocery stores typically process or plan their sales several weeks in advance. They plan their featuring many weeks in advance, and they purchase that product typically several weeks ahead of when it's actually in the grocery store. So the meat that was in there when the thing first hit was meat that had been purchased sometime before, and typically packing plants on any given week are making product that's already committed someplace. There's not necessarily on any given day a lot of freely available product. And so that's why you saw that tremendous increase in boxed beef prices. In about a three-day period, choice boxed beef went up about 19%. And that was just a scramble to meet an unexpected surge in consumer demand at that grocery store level. And so over time, you can fix those problems a little bit. Michael did a nice job of pointing out that, again, the food service and the retail grocery side are very specialized supply chains. And so you can't just move product from one to the other. The folks that are cutting portion control steaks for restaurants are not really set up in the short run to do case-ready product for grocery stores. And so it takes some time to do that. The other thing that's going on when that happens is you've got a distinction between the immediate supply and demand conditions that we just described, for example, in the boxed beef market, same thing can happen in the cattle markets, versus the expectations that we have down the road. And of course, that's what futures markets are really intended to do, is to be focusing on our expectations for what's coming, sometimes in a fairly near future, sometimes longer term. And so we've had tremendous distinction, if you will, between the immediate market conditions in many cases and those expectations going forward. While we were trying to deal with product shortages in the short run, the futures market and the fed cattle markets were recognizing that in a week or two, we're going to be past some of this. Not only that, we've got tremendous shocks to the economy. We've got folks laid off. We've got unemployment rising rapidly. That's going to be a problem for beef demand at some point down the road. So that distinction really creates a separation between current supply and demand conditions and our expectations of the future. And so it looks like those markets are moving in opposite directions. And in fact, they are in the very short run, but they're doing it for very specific reasons. And over time, they will realign. And of course, we've got to get past some of this uncertainty and volatility.
Michael or Scott, would you guys like to jump in with any additions to what Dr. Peel had to say?
No, I think he did a great job explaining that, really hammering home also on that future prices are really an expectation of what people are expecting in the future. So everything he just said was hitting the nail on the head.
Great. Then another question that we've been seeing pop up a lot are questions about packer profitability. Economists often point out that there's differences between pricing and profitability. What is the reality of packer profits right now in the cattle industry?
I guess I'll take a shot at that first. Again, it's not necessarily an easy thing to get a handle on. The temptation is, and you see this a lot, people will take that spike that I mentioned in boxed beef prices and apply that to, a week's worth of production or something. But as I said earlier, most of the time, a good share of what the packer might be processing this week is meat that was previously purchased for whatever market channel it's going to. Sometimes that spot or that immediate cash boxed beef price is not necessarily reflective of what they're doing. That's not to say that they didn't make more money through this deal. They certainly did, but in the it's I think sometimes the calculations are a little bit overstated in terms of that. Obviously, right now, if you look at what, even with the box beef price having come down from that short-run spike, it's still elevated to what it was in the 1st of March, for example. But we know that, you know, packers are paying extra money to their labor force because it's, call it hazard pay, if you will. In some cases, they're paying workers that are not working. They're paying them to stay home in some cases. So, you know, we never really talk about the cost side that much. We don't always know what the details are. So the bottom line is, you know, in a short run like this, packers do make more money. I don't think they make as much more money as a lot of people want to attribute to them. But the other thing is that over time, you know, it tends to come around the other way. And there certainly are instances where packers are on the other side of this with very, very poor margins. And we don't talk about that a lot either, typically, when it happens. So, you know, I don't think it's as extreme of a profit situation as some people would tend to think.
And this is Michael. I'll just add on to that a little bit. I again, 100% agree with him. They definitely made some money, just probably not as much as a lot of people initially thought they did. Really, when it comes down to it, the only way you're going to get what their actual margins are is by them giving you those numbers, and that's never going to happen. The best we can do is try and do our best to estimate everything from the outside looking in. Now, one way that he had kind of mentioned doing that, the reason I want to mention it is that this isn't an exact measure. Just to put it in perspective, though, is this concept of a live to cutout spread. It's not a margin. It's just basically the difference between the outputs minus the inputs. It's a calculation put together by the folks over at Livestock Marketing Information Center. They do a fantastic job. But it did spike considerably. One event that that this COVID situation is getting compared to is the Tyson fire back in Holcomb, Kansas in August. The most recent spike in the live to cutout spread is actually below where it was during the Tyson fire, even though the box beef cutout increased about double what it did during the Tyson fire in 7 days, in a week's worth of time. Part of that is fed cattle prices aren't exactly where they were at the same time as the Tyson fire. And then there's also some additional value that the packer gets from the byproducts, the hide, blood meal, bone meal, things like that. They're actually currently getting a lot less than they did during the Tyson fire. So that's another thing to keep in mind is it isn't always what it initially looks like whenever people compare it. I also keep in mind this idea of the marginal capacity. Even if you do see, and right now we're seeing slaughter fall, but if you see a little bit of an increase in slaughter during those times, it's not the same. Adding an extra shift is a lot more costly than running at normal capacity and normal pace. Shifting cattle around the system and making them move further distances is going to cost the packer a lot more money than operating in normal times.
Great, thank you. The next question, and Michael, I'll pose this one to you to start off with, is that looking at a national scale, another point of uncertainty we had some questions revolving around is just wondering what would happen if we had more processing plants come down with workers who end up being impacted and infected with COVID-19, much like the Smithfield plant in South Dakota made national news about. So within the industry, what role does that uncertainty of a potential plant shutdown anywhere in the country, what does that play in the price making process that we're seeing in the meatpacking industry today?
This is an issue that I think scares me a lot moving, at least in short term to medium term. I think I use the Holcomb fire as an example, and it's just easy to draw some parallels to, even though it's a very different situation, and I don't want to make it seem like it is the same. I think this is a little bit scarier than the Holcomb fire in that whenever we had the Holcomb fire happen, the immediate price movements you saw in the cutouts and in cattle prices made sense economically. I know it was frustrating for many of our members, many of our producers, watching the value of the cutouts skyrocket while they're getting a lower price for their cattle. I get it and I understand. But what really happened in that instance is you essentially had 6% of processing capacity in the country disappear overnight. That means you have an immediate oversupply of fed cattle and an immediate undersupply of meat, and then you have retailers and food service who were still in business at the time, panicking and panic buying what they could to drive up the value of the cutouts. And then they were trying to figure out what to do with all these cattle that were going into the plant and trying to shift them to other plants. It really was a situation where I worry about a similar reaction moving forward, except with one big difference. That was a single event. Granted, it was for a longer period of time. They were out from August to pretty much the rest of the year. Whereas now you have all these individual plants closing down 1 week, 2 week, 3 weeks at a time at different points in the country. And it just adds so much more uncertainty. The initial reaction that we saw with the spike in the cutout at the beginning of this COVID-19, that was all demand driven down at the end consumer. Panic buying at the grocery stores was driving a lot of that. Now I think you could start to see a situation where you have a bunch of almost mini fires, and each time something like that happens, it's going to put downward pressure on the cattle prices that many of our producers are trying to sell. I think, again, that's an area that gives me heartburn and kind of gives me concern. I might be overreacting to it. I don't know if Scott or Dr. Bill has anything to say on that.
I share your concerns, Michael. I think this is different because it's the only time in history that I'm aware of where we have the potential for multiple plants across the species or within a species, as well as multiple plants across the species. So there's a lot of potential here for some really serious, again, bottlenecks, if you will, in terms of lack of capacity within beef. It could, pork industry is facing the same thing. The poultry industry is facing the same thing. And so there's some protein market level aggregation that also is a concern. So, it is, now the other side of it, as you pointed out, the packing plant fire was a single event. It was over. It took several months to get that plant back online. The plants today, any individual plant that's affected is likely to not be out of service or at reduced service for too long, although in some cases we don't know exactly how long. But there's this potential for sort of the perfect storm of a lot of plants being affected at a single time that could really be dramatic. And then the question is not even so much lower prices for cattle or hogs or whatever the input is to that processing facility, but literally not enough test capacity available to actually process animals that need to be processed. And we're already seeing a little bit of that on the poultry side. I don't think that'll happen on the beef side, but it could mean that we have some significant delays and extra cost associated with holding those animals if we have to schedule them in due to a lack of capacity.
All right. The next question that we have is one that I will pose again to Michael to start with, just because of your portfolio at AFBF with cattle markets as well as dairy. We had a question about, is there anything being done or even anything that can be done to ensure that the beef processing chain continues? And you talked about this at the beginning of some of the issues with that beef processing chain, but to ensure it continues so we don't have a situation similar to maybe something that is happening in the milk supply chain recently with some of the bad news we've seen in the dairy industry.
Sure. And I may lightly touch on it because, and not to throw Scott under the bus on this one, but I'm sure he has some to say about actions that are being taken at the USDA level, as well as actions American Farm Bureau, Oklahoma Farm Bureau are taking. But the dairy situation is also incredibly scary to me. You got folks dumping milk on the ground. Dairy, beef, and hogs are taking this pretty hard. It's a really, really difficult time for them, for everybody involved. Actions being taken. I know we had made a few comments earlier about, the packers were making money whenever this first started. I don't know how long that's really going to continue as they struggle with these labor challenges. They're kind of offering incentives to workers. Granted, I don't know if it's enough, but that's actions that are being taken, at least at the packer level, is these bonuses for workers that don't miss a day or complete however many weeks of their shifts without a single absence if they can avoid it. And some of this, no matter how much money you offer it, it's going to be hard to convince someone to go to work when they're legitimately afraid of contracting the virus and bringing it home to their family. I think the packers are spending more money to try and keep those plants open. I can't emphasize enough, and Scott touched on this, is how important that those plants remain open, because if you start seeing that, not just from a, we focus on what's happening to the producer, that at a producer level would be monumental, but also from a retail consumer level, we already saw all those pictures floating around on social media of empty grocery shelves. Consumers don't fully understand that, at least previously, those empty grocery shelves were due to the fact that it was just a short-term supply chain issue, and it's going to, the food's there, it's going to take a little while to get there. We might be finding ourselves, hopefully we don't, in a situation where the food's there, technically it's just in cow, steer, heifer form. We need someone to take that animal and process it into meat for the consumer. And if that's not happening, you could start seeing a little bit of an issue in terms of adequate supply of meat to the consumer. Other actions being taken, USDA is absolutely on this as best they can be. You have the CARES action being taken. I don't know, Scott, if you have anything to say that. You're a little bit more dialed in with what's happening on the Hill and over at USDA.
Yeah, this is Scott Bennett. I'll add some color there. I think it's important for folks to realize, you know, when this pandemic first started, we saw the packing plants at 85-90% capacity. A lot of the workers were walking off the floor. You know, if you have a young child whose school has been canceled or you know your child is no longer in school, you're going to stay at home with that child. And I think it's important to realize too that in the packing industry, you know, there's such a shortage of workers that if I'm a line worker at a packing plant and I quit a week from now, if I go back to that same plant and ask for my job back, they'll give it to me because they need the workforce. And so the workers understand that they have that upper hand. So you see a lot of fluidity in the workforce coming and going to some degree. So we initially saw this workforce decline due to the fact that kids were at home, parents needed to stay at home with their children, and there was, you know, a little bit of fear in play with this pandemic. You know, as time has progressed, and you know, weeks seem like months or years at this point, but as we see time progress, that workforce has been extremely limited. I mean, you're seeing packing plants at 40, 50, 60% of the workforce showing up. I can't even imagine what that means to, you know, the line speeds in these plants. That being said, whether it be based on fact or rumor, these workers see this $2.2 trillion government spending program, and they see what that could mean to a boost in an unemployment check. And if I'm a line worker and I do the math on the back of a napkin, and it makes more sense for me to take the unemployment check than show up at the plant, I'm going to take the unemployment check. And that's unfortunate, and that cannot happen. We at American Farm Bureau have worked with the National Pork Producers Council. They are organizing letters to be sent to all 50 governors, explaining the situation that the packing industry is in, pretty much explaining, you know, to each governor, look, if a line worker quits, they are not eligible for unemployment. And if they quit, they can't file for unemployment. They can't get the benefits that they see on the news that this aid package provides. Now, if they are furloughed, or if a plant feels the need to really reduce their capacity and they are furloughed, then they do qualify for this unemployment. And if they go and they get their unemployment check, and it's more beneficial for them to sit at home on the couch than it is for them to work at the plant, that's what they're going to do. And we need to make sure that these governors work the plan, work the unemployment, and implement this program in a way that encourages people to go back to work, because these plants are, it's imperative that they remain open. I mean, again, it's all throughput. We have to keep these plants open, and the workers need to be there. And when we look at, this dichotomy of unemployment versus actually working in the plant, it's important that we really preach that to our governors, because they have the authority to implement this unemployment that the federal government gives them the authority to. And, it has to be managed in a way that these plant workers are incentivized to return to work and not take the unemployment if the plant, is operational.
Dr. Peel, we have had some questions from some cattle producers who are weighing their options right now. They might have some stalker cattle out on wheat, and they're looking at what they should be doing as we see prices and markets quite volatile. Is there any guidance that you have, or just some indicators that people should consider to guide their decisions as they consider whether or not to hold on to animals right now as cattle that they have on the place, or whether to sell them?
Well, that's a tough question. Obviously, certainly we are in an unprecedented situation. So we really don't have any background in history in terms of trying to interpret or think about how this might play out. That said, given where we are at the moment, it just seems to me, based on, really twofold. Again, the first priority in the country is to deal with the virus and the human health things that are going on across the country. And it does appear that we are beginning to see some progress in that, but we're a ways away from getting past that. There's going to continue to be a lot of uncertainty. I say all that to say, from when you translate all of that back down into cattle markets, in all honesty, I don't see a lot of potential for things to change a great deal in the next 1 to 2 months, 30 to 60 days. In fact, I think there's still some risk to the downside. We'd like to think that we're getting close to the bottom. And if we don't have these kinds of plant capacity issues we've been talking about, we probably are kind of close to the bottom. There's still some risk to the downside. I think there's relatively little potential to the upside in that, 30 to 60 day time frame. And we may have to extend that out depending on how long it takes to see some progress. Beyond that, I actually have more questions. Unfortunately, on the short run, I'm more convinced that it's probably not good. But going further on, there's even more uncertainty in the third and fourth quarters of the year. We have a couple of different scenarios. We could be, particularly by the fourth quarter of the year, we'd hope that we're past the virus and then well on our way to bringing the economy back online and seeing a significant recovery. I think the third quarter is very suspect in that. Fourth quarter is probably iffy at this point, but at some point we are going to see that. So there's some real question marks in that time frame. It depends on where you are, obviously, with cattle. If you've got cattle right now, for example, if you have some cattle on wheat pasture, you're grazing out, you're probably not going to have a great deal of flexibility in doing something with those cattle, other than maybe take them to the feedlot. Beyond that, I think there's a lot of reason to be extremely cautious during that time period. Waiting is risky, but at some point in time, we are going to see some turnaround. So as you think towards the fall, maybe we're thinking about spring-born calves that we'll be marketing in the fall, I think at this point, I would not be in a real big panic to price those cattle at this point. Give it a little more time. I don't think there's any guarantee that we're going to be better by then. There is at least some potential at this point.
Great. Scott, we haven't had a chance for you to kick off a question yet. So I just wanted a chance to ask. I know last week we saw USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue tweeted that the USDA, I'm going to quote his tweet, that USDA Packers and Stockyards Division will be extending our oversight to determine the causes of divergence between box and live beef prices, end quote. Has there been any further action that you've seen in D.C. or in the circles that you're conversing with people within after that tweet?
Yeah, so I'll give a little historical perspective first, and then I'll answer the question. So the Holcomb, Kansas Tyson beef plant fire happened in August of 2019. We saw a 6% reduction in the weekly cattle kill. That spurred an enormous reaction from the countryside to investigate or look into the cattle markets as they became extremely volatile after that fire happened. Undersecretary Greg Ibaugh at AMS within USDA Ag Marketing Service, he initiated an investigation and a look into the markets and the volatility. They claim to come to a conclusion of that investigation at the end of 2019. Here we are in April, we have not seen that. But that being said, we've remained in close communication with the undersecretary, and we have reiterated at American Farm Bureau, we've written several letters as this pandemic has progressed. And one of the first things we addressed to him was, please continue to monitor these cattle markets and the volatility as this COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic progresses. We've seen that. We are working closely with USDA. Again, as you mentioned, that tweet from Secretary Perdue, they are very closely monitoring the cattle markets and making sure that there's no manipulation by the four major packers of this. And certainly if there are, that is, they can be persecuted by the Department of Justice. As I mentioned earlier, Colin Peterson, the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, has sent a letter to the Department of Justice and CFTC, the Commodities Future Trading Commission, about this issue. And we have encouraged Ag Marketing Service to continue and monitor these markets. We know that our members are extremely sensitive to it, and it is the matter of a black or red bottom line on some of their cattle operations. And so this is to be taken very seriously. And they have been extremely receptive to that. Our team has remained in close communication with all of those above, as Michael Nephew mentioned, CFTC, CME, USDA. And so we are monitoring that very closely. That being said, we are still waiting the results of that investigation or that study that AMS is to do from the August Holcomb fire. At this point, based on tweets from the undersecretary, from Secretary Perdue, that will also incorporate whatever volatility has come from this corona pandemic. So, that being said, we wait with bated breath the results of the study from the Secretary of Agriculture on the volatility in our cattle markets.
Now, Dr. Peel, a question for you. We have had some members who've pointed out that the volatility in the futures markets is kind of making it difficult for them to use futures in a traditional hedging strategy. And they've also been wondering about the ability of the futures market to really reflect what our farmers and ranchers are seeing in the cattle market. What are your thoughts on the status of the futures market right now and how our cattle producers should be viewing those or using those?
Well, the futures markets have been extraordinarily volatile. I didn't do a count recently. I heard something the other day that I don't remember, 16 out of the previous 20 or 21 days we had had limit moves. That's not the way you really want those markets to function on an ongoing basis. But we, again, are in a totally unprecedented situation. There's a lot of, not only is there a lot of uncertainty, there's just a lot of differences in people's levels of uncertainty and even the direction of uncertainty in some cases. And so we're seeing these markets reflect that. It does make it harder when those markets are so incredibly volatile on a day-to-day basis. And of course, when they do have limit moves, they get locked and you actually can't trade them for some period of time, maybe until tomorrow. And so that does make it hard sometimes for producers to get in and out. This is an extreme example that is provoked by the situation we find ourselves in. To some extent, it's been a degree of an issue for some period of time, particularly in the feeder cattle futures complex. The feeder cattle contract, frankly, from the day it began in the 1970s, has always been a relatively thinly traded market. And so it was always a little bit of a challenge to have the kind of liquidity in that market that you really need for it to function as well as you would like. It works, but there have been challenges in that. Over the last decade or so, as we have moved almost entirely to computer-based trading, there's a lot of the outside money that comes into commodity markets that's managed and operationally done with computerized algorithms, and those can work both ways. They can actually smooth out markets and keep them from overreacting, but they can also provoke overreactions. And when we get into the kind of situation we're in right now, I think that's also part of the issue. We tend to sort of trip the trigger and run the market both up and down in ways that really kind of overshoot, and then we correct and so on. Sometimes we get sort of trapped in that pattern. So it's a challenge. There's a number of issues there that are related. The volatility is related to the current situation. There's some underlying more fundamental reasons that are there as well. The main thing is that we have to get past the level of uncertainty that we're in right now until we can sort of see our way clear through this thing. And the markets will settle down and they will begin to offer opportunities. Obviously, right now we're at a point where we're really not, for the most part, talking about risk management opportunities. Some people would have had some risk management in place back in January, say, when all of this sort of began, and that helped them through this process. If you didn't have that in place, right now there's not a lot of opportunities to invoke risk management, although I had said earlier, and I still think there is some downside risk, so it's still worth considering to some extent. For an individual producer now, it's probably not a question really of implementing a risk management plan. Given where we find ourselves today, we're probably talking about managing through this financially to try to minimize the damage and survive this thing, and then be prepared to take advantage of opportunities that will come at some point in time as we get through this and move on down the road.
Great. Michael, we have a question that I think might be a good fit for you as you look at the issues that American Farm Bureau is working through. We've had a question about how are the current unsettled issues, the volatility that we've seen in both the pork and the poultry markets, how are those interacting potentially with the beef market?
This is certainly not isolated to beef. I know the concentration here that we were looking at was going to be primarily on the cattle markets and the beef markets. Pork markets have been taking it, again, I think I mentioned earlier, pretty hard. The same disparity that we saw happen in the beef cutout as a result of the panic buying, the food service channels closing down altogether, you saw really similar things start happening over in the pork markets as well. So one kind of just absolutely crazy disparity is what's happening with pork bellies. They've been kind of a fairy tale story the last several years. They were heavily popular in food service and also at home for a period of time. And the value went up. They've been incredibly valuable. And earlier this year, sorry, as I'm talking, I'm pulling up the data and trying to stall. They were going for the pork belly primal was around $120. Then COVID started to hit, a week ago, 2 weeks. They were trading in the 35, well, definitely under 40 range. That drop was just astounding and tremendous. You never see pork bellies down at the same level of the ham in terms of the pork cutout. That's because as the whole country starts essentially sheltering in place and restaurants are closing, bacon is heavily reliant upon food service. You saw a lot of bacon being consumed on bacon double cheeseburgers, McDonald's breakfast, Denny's breakfast going out. So as consumers stop going to that, like, yeah, people eat bacon at home, but they tend to find additional ways to use it in a lot of those food service items. So that's one where you're seeing a similar picture happen in some of these other markets. You also mentioned poultry. They are absolutely struggling as well. I mentioned earlier the cattle slaughter cratering about 20% over the last 3 weeks or so, 19%. Hog slaughter also declined, not to the same extent cattle slaughter did. You're seeing them breaking eggs instead of continuing on with hatching in the poultry sector. That's also because that shoulder-to-shoulder work, they're expecting a slowdown further down the line. I just heard earlier today, our own president at American Farm Bureau, Zippy Duvall, he's a poultry farmer. He was talking about, he's worried about the delay in between flocks. And, you know, a lot of these poultry farmers, not specifically talking about him, just in general in this industry, they take on a lot of debt to finance these houses. And that is predicated upon this idea that I'm going to get 5 turns this year. If you slow it down enough, that pushes it down to 4 turns this year. You just lost 20% of your annual income just by being, in this case, it's not manipulation. It's not a bad, it's not vindictive on behalf of anybody. It's just the way the market's reacting right now and all of that uncertainty about what demand is eventually going to be and whether or not you'll even be able to process those birds. I know, I think there was a question in there. I don't think we've talked about it very much. A lot of our animal protein system in the U.S. relies very heavily on this almost just-in-time delivery system. Everything is incredibly efficient, particularly in the poultry and pork side of things. They get a very specified amount of time to clean out in between flocks, in between pigs. Pigs, part of the reason they got to be sold on Tuesday is because on Wednesday you got to wash out. You got another arrival of pigs coming in on Thursday. It's that kind of day by day, everything is working. It's like cogs in a machine. Everything's working efficiently. Cattle, it's not invincible to this, but you got a little bit more ability. Like one of the questions earlier on, do I sell now? Do I hold, sell at heavier weight? You can feed them out a little bit longer. You just really don't have that necessarily in the pork and poultry side of things. So I think that's a struggle that you're seeing across all of animal protein is this COVID-19 as we watch it decimate demand at the food service and restaurant sectors. Same as in beef, you can't just flip a switch and move all this product that had been going there in terms of pork and poultry over to the retail sector. Farmers across America are getting hit by this. This is not isolated to one animal protein, and quite frankly, it's not isolated to animal protein in general. Ethanol's taken it, milk's taken it, other especially crops are having to plow under crops. This is a very difficult time for American agriculture in general.
Scott, one question that we had asked a couple times is what we're seeing, especially you guys at American Farm Bureau, coming down the pike potentially of any type of disaster-style payments to livestock producers in the near future. I know you've talked a little bit about what may or may not be in the CARES Act implications for the livestock industry, but what about perhaps a disaster-style payment?
Yeah, so... to that point, I think it's important to look back at the CARES Act, and of that $24 billion, $9.5 billion's been earmarked to some degree for specialty crops and livestock. There's going to be this political battle now among livestock groups to see how much of that $9.5 billion they can get. That is going to be the, this emergency relief dollars is going to come from that $9.5 billion. There's been some discussion about opening up the Commodity Credit Corporation, the CCC, which I mentioned gets $14 billion of this $2.2 trillion to replenish the CCC up to $30 billion. There will be discussions to have that open to livestock. American Farm Bureau is open to that discussion. We think that if livestock producers cannot be made whole through the $9.5 billion, then opening it up to CCC certainly makes sense to us. There's also the ELAP, Emergency Livestock Payment Program, which is a program that would funnel money out of the CCC. We're looking into whether or not ELAP makes sense for payment to producers that have seen a significant reduction in the value of their commodity, in this example, cattle. So we are working with USDA on that to see whether or not there's an appetite to tap into CCC. But I think before we do that, we need to see exactly how much of this $9.5 billion is going to come to livestock. And I'll take this opportunity to mention, if you read the news or you see things, we've had this phase three been implemented, right? This is the $2.2 trillion. Folks are already talking about phase four, or at one point in time, it was 3.5. And it's up to Speaker Pelosi in the House to bring this forward at this point. And a lot of folks are asking us, what is the livestock sector going to ask for in this phase four of, trying to bring this economy back up to speed? My answer to that is, well, we don't know. We don't know what we're going to get out of, I'm not going to rob Peter to pay Paul. So I don't know how much of phase three we have. Let's say we get a significant portion of this $9.5 billion and it's equitable and it all makes sense, then there's not going to be a lot of need politically to go and ask for a lot of money in phase four. But if for whatever reason in this, in the implementation from USDA, that we don't receive what we feel is equitable amount for livestock in the CARES Act, then we will have a significant dollar ask out of phase four. But the problem is we don't know what phase four looks like. We have no skeleton. We have no blueprint. We don't know what that means. We are monitoring that. But right now at American Farm Bureau, our eyes are set on, making the cow-calf and cattle producers in the countryside right through this phase three, through CARES Act, and this $9.5 billion that we have to work with, and whatever percentage of that we receive, it'll be imperative that we implement that in an equitable way across all folks in the cattle industry.
Thank you to everyone who submitted comments. As we draw to a close, we are going to give each panelist a chance to give their closing thoughts, starting with you, Dr. Peel, if you'd like to share your final thoughts with our webinar attendees.
Excuse me, I was muted. We recognize that this is an absolutely unprecedented time for all of us to deal with in all sorts of ways, as consumers, as families, as agricultural producers, as ag industries. There's a tremendous amount of stress and frustration happening right now, a lot of impacts on our markets, tremendous amount of things that are out of our control at this point in time, whether it's as an individual or as an industry or even as an agricultural sector. Again, we're talking about things that impact the entire U.S. economy and indeed the entire global economy. So, we've got a lot to work through. We haven't done anything like this realistically ever before. And so there's a lot of uncharted territory here. That said, we will get through this. There's plenty of challenges along the way, but we will come out of this. And one of the things that I guess I would, from a purely markets, cattle market standpoint, or maybe a protein market standpoint, that I would remind folks, we started this year with overall expectations from a cattle standpoint that we would probably see some stronger prices, particularly in the second half of the year. That's probably not going to happen now. We've clearly, we're gonna deal with some lower prices. We've revised our expectations down. We're going to be on the defense probably for the entire year, rather than anything that you would call any sort of aggressive, production plans and opportunities in the market. But we also started the year recognizing that because of things like African swine fever that had hit China and other countries so hard last year, created a global protein deficit that was going to provide tremendous opportunities for, first and foremost, for the pork industry, but ultimately for all protein markets. And of course, China has already gone through much of the coronavirus thing, and that did cause long-term impact for them. But the basic protein deficit is still there, and those market opportunities are still there. And in fact, we are exporting a lot of pork, and we're trying to get ourselves to a point where we can begin to look at those global market opportunities. In the U.S., as was pointed out earlier, reopening half of our market, the food service side of it, a little bit more than half of our market, is probably going to take some time. But we went into this thing with a strong economy that was built on consumer spending. If we can get the economy back open, get those folks back to work, there's no reason why we can't pick that back up. We don't know exactly when. We don't know exactly how long it's going to take. But, we didn't start this in a really anemic macro economy environment. We started it strong. We got hit by a tremendous shock. So we have to work our way through this and get through this and then look for those opportunities that will be there at some point in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Peel. Scott, do you have any closing thoughts or statements that you'd like to share with our group?
Sure. I'd just like to emphasize the fact that here I sit, less than a mile from our nation's capital. I'm rather anxious in a work from home environment to be away from my family's farming operation and cattle operation in Southside, Virginia. For those people that wake up at dawn and ride to their ranch in Oklahoma and wonder if anyone in Washington is paying attention to the concerns or the needs of people in the countryside, we are. I'm here. I wake up in the middle of the night concerned for the needs of the people that keep this supply chain moving, people that raise cattle, sell cattle. I would just like to emphasize that if you have any questions or if you have any needs or concerns, please reach out to Oklahoma Farm Bureau. They might be a flight away from Washington, but I tell you what, they are on the front lines with your senators and congressmen to work and make right the needs of the cattle producers in your state. I encourage you to reach out to them. They will in turn reach out to me if needed. But I would just like to emphasize that while we are all in dire straits and a little bit of widespread panic over the markets in a whole, that there are people in Washington that are working diligently on your behalf. And I would I leave that to you, Dustin. But thank you to everyone for the opportunity to present our case here with Oklahoma Farm Bureau. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. We appreciate it. And Michael, do you have any comments or statements that you'd like to offer for our group?
Well, to be honest, I kind of think Dr. Peel and Scott already stole my lines. So just to reiterate a few things that they'd mentioned, this is a huge challenge facing the industry right now. But long term, I 100% agree with Dr. Peel. I feel like I've been saying that all night because he's right. Long term, I'm still very bullish on animal protein. Heading into this year, we were in a pretty good position. Per capita beef consumption had been on the rise. We were looking at record production, but we were also looking at record exports last year. We're looking at beef being in a really good position, especially when you talk about that animal protein gap or deficit that is existing around the world, and who around the world has the ability to fill that. I think American farmer and ranchers were standing ready before any of that before any of this COVID-19 stuff happened. And also to reiterate some of what Scott said, if you're hearing something, we are a grassroots organization. All of our policies, all of our directives, all the work that we do is directed by members like you. So if you have concerns, if you have frustrations, we absolutely want to hear about them. You can reach out to American Farm Bureau. Oklahoma Farm Bureau is, again, fantastic. You got a great group of staff, great group of people working there on your behalf, and we're trying our best to work in the nation's capital on your and on their behalf. So, again, just please, we're a grassroots organization. We can't exist without members like y'all. So please let us know what we can do to help you.
Well, thank you again to each and every one of our guest panelists. I know that all of our members have appreciated your expertise and your input on these issues as we face these very uncertain and very interesting times. Lastly, I'll throw it to Oklahoma Farm Bureau President Rod Mozell to kind of wrap all this up for our Oklahoma Farm Bureau members.
Well, what a great panel. We're very appreciative of all three of these outstanding gentlemen. To have Daryl Peel on the staff at OSU and to have him as truly one of the national leaders and on this subject matter, and one who's and we can turn to not just in Oklahoma, but that leaders all over the nation turn to. And then I hope you all have enjoyed getting a chance to meet our two outstanding AFBF staffers, both Scott and Michael, and seen some of their talent. And we'll try to involve them again regularly in the future. We wish there were simple answers in this subject matter, but these are very, very complicated questions and very complicated markets. Just a few weeks ago, 54% of all the food was basically going through institutional channels, and somewhere around 46% was going through groceries. And in the matter of a couple of weeks around our country, nobody knows exactly the breakdown now, but probably something like 80% is going through groceries now. Some people say even 85%. And so the institutional has lost huge market share while the grocery market has picked up. And in addition to all the other disruptions that we're experiencing, that's had a huge impact. And so we've also gotten to see how fragile the supply chain is sometimes. And one of our strengths has always been this amazing just-in-time delivery channels. But whenever things have problems, well, then that can really surface some weak spots in that. And so it's really been amazing how resilient and how quickly these huge markets have adapted and will need to continue to adapt in the time ahead. We'd love to see more packers, so we're not dependent just on four major packers in the country. We'd like to see more local packers and more local beef processing opportunities. In fact, the Oklahoma Cattlemen's Association is going to have a webinar tomorrow midday on promoting how you can market your beef locally and how you can possibly develop some local markets. We'd encourage you to tune in to watch our friends at Oklahoma Cattlemen and as they try to explore some of those possibilities. And we work hard to work together to find some solutions for the cattle markets and the beef deal. A couple other things just to wrap up that we've been doing at Oklahoma Farm Bureau. We were one of the states that jumped on first on an initiative effort with our good friends in Texas and Oklahoma and a lot of the other southern states to do a letter to Secretary Perdue. It's probably been close to 2 weeks ago now, right after the CARES Act passed, to make a strong case for why a big part of that support out of the CARES Act ought to be directed to the beef and cattle industry and to our small producers across this state. A lot of you may not realize, but we actually have the second highest cattle count of any state in the country. So we're the number two state, and it's always frustrating to us that we don't have more of the value added on the beef. And that again comes back to the point that we're encouraging discussions and talks about how we can encourage more packers or more of that value added to occur in our state, since we have so many of the cattle here. And we'll continue to do that. The Packers and Stockyard Act comes up for renewal this fall sometime at Congress. And so we think that's maybe another important opportunity to have some leverage to look at this whole, at all the issues related to packers and stockyards. And so we'll be deeply involved with AFBF to address that. We also are very excited about the support of our own Oklahoma Ag Secretary, Blaine Arthur, and she stepped forward to appeal to Secretary Perdue to expand the investigation of the packers and of the overall cattle markets that was started after the Hocum fire, to expand that to all the implications from the COVID-19 market disruptions that we've seen. And so we were excited to be able to stand up and support Blaine Arthur and those initiatives that she's taken in that regard. So we're always hunting for opportunities to stand up and try to make a difference for our Oklahoma Farm Bureau members. We hope that you see that value and will continue to be Oklahoma Farm Bureau members, and encourage your friends and neighbors to be Oklahoma Farm Bureau members, so that can magnify our clout and allow us to speak even more on your behalf. So thank you so very much for joining us tonight. Please let us know with phone calls and text and emails whether this information is helpful and what other programming we can bring to you to be of service. So thanks again for your attendance tonight and to our outstanding panelists. And we'll look forward to better days ahead as spring comes to Oklahoma.
Thank you, Rod, and we appreciate all of our members and everyone who is interested for calling in and connecting with us on our Cattle Industry Update webinar. There will be a survey at the end of the webinar, so please take a few minutes and fill it out so we can make good decisions and be able to provide more programs for our members and for Oklahoma agriculture. If you don't get a survey tonight, there will be one hopefully in your email tomorrow. Also, we invite anyone who's not a Farm Bureau member to join Oklahoma Farm Bureau. Your membership dues allow us to be able to put on programs like this, and everyone who's an Oklahoma Farm Bureau member is also an American Farm Bureau member and gets all the benefits of having great folks like Michael and Scott representing us and our interests in Oklahoma agriculture in Washington, D.C. with American Farm Bureau. If you would like the audio from this program, we will be posting it to our Oklahoma Farm Bureau website as soon as we can get it prepared and uploaded. Thank you again to all of our panelists. We really appreciate your time helping share an update with the cattle industry, with our members and our Oklahoma agriculturalists. And thank you again for attending. We hope you found this informative. Have a good evening.